is now 11:11 here at WCCO. Welcome back to the John Hines Show. I'm your host filling in today, Jerilyn Steele. It is what I love to do is be here with you, and I'm learning, and hopefully you are learning too. Boy, you know, I've been hearing about, you know, you see all these movies on that come out of Hollywood on television and in the movie theaters, apocalyptic, you know, or post-apocalyptic, and there are many people that really believe that we are going to seriously know need to know how to survive. There are reality shows about, you know, the five fat guys or the fat guys in the woods, about learning how to create fire, that sort of thing. And so it seems as though when it comes to television and movies, they're trying to prepare us. They're trying to tell us you might want to learn how to discern between a mushroom that'll kill you and one that doesn't when you're in the wild. And some really do prepare for this, and they are called preppers. Do you know what a prepper is? We have a lot of them here in the United States. Well, joining us to talk about this is Steve Hart. He's from the UK, and he himself is a prepper. How are you, Steve?
Yes, I'm fine, thanks. Good day to you, Geraldine.
Oh, welcome to WCCO. Okay, as we talk about preppers, a lot of people wonder, how far do you go, and why do you feel it necessary to become a prepper? So let's define who you are.
Well, it's just another type of insurance policy, really. I mean, it's nothing over the top. It's certainly nothing like the doomsday style TV programs that you see these days. I mean, they'll take the most extreme of extremes and show them to be completely nutcases. Most preppers are just normal, run-of-the-mill people. They're just looking to take out a little bit more insurance for the what-ifs. But just in case, you know, what happens if the grid goes down, if, you know, might be for a couple of days, might be for a week, might be for more. You know, could you survive it? It's not rocket science. It's just having a little bit of extra insurance to make sure that you're going to be able to keep going when others are struggling, basically.
You just mentioned the grid. It's quite remarkable here in the United States. We have a network called House and Garden Television, and they have a show called Off the Grid. There are many Americans that are moving off the grid. They're getting off of it completely, going to areas like Alaska, and choosing to do this because they believe exactly what you believe. There will come a time that we need to know how to do this, so why not do it now? Are you starting to say that you're moving away from the grid?
In a way, yes. I don't think in the UK, it's not so much that you'll move away from the grid. It's just that you, should something happen, you can be a lot more self-sufficient. You know, solar power, wind power, etc. In this country is quite high. We haven't got the huge, vast expanses that you've got in the States and Canada and places like that. I mean, we've got like 65 million people crammed into an island the size of a postage stamp. You know,
right.
you can't go very far before you bump into somebody. So with regard to going really off-grid, there are people that do it, quite a few in the UK, but it's we take a different take on it. We tend to think, you know, let's make our own power, you know, make our own resources at home, so that should something happen, at least we can carry on.
So how does the UK look at preppers? Do they assume that you're all, you know, ones who want to, who believe in the apocalypse and that you're preparing for it?
No, it's. I mean, we're British. We're sort of just stiff upper lip. We're laid back. You know, we're not the tin hat wearing nutcases that run around with, you know, digging, you know, sort of 100-foot bunkers and filling them up with just about everything. The prepping in the UK is very much an underground movement. It's very low key, but it does go on. I mean, my website gets a huge number of hits, and it's got a huge amount of readership, which tells me, you know, that there is a following, there is a need for it, and consequently, it's not in your face. That'd be the way to explain it, really, in the UK. I mean, I go to a lot of prepper meetings, a lot of related events, and everybody's the same. Everybody's just happily getting on with it, basically. It's just, it's not really out there, but it is certainly going on as an underground movement, and quite a big underground movement in the UK.
When I first read about preppers or survivalists maybe a decade ago, I started really researching it and figuring out why do people feel this way. And then I realized that this was something that, you know, children were taught. If you live on a farm, you're taught how to survive. If you're part of the 4-H Club or the Boys Girls, you know, Girl Scouts of America here in our great country, you're preparing for this sort of thing. You know what to look for. You know how to go hiking and survive. So that we as humans, we have always been like this. And then the Y2K scare, I don't know about in the UK, it was really scary here. And many people stocked up their pantries and bought generators and that sort of thing to prepare. So why is it that we're uncomfortable when we hear about people like you preparing?
I don't know. It's very strange. We are only doing what our great-grandparents had done in the past. You've only got to go back a few generations when you think, well, hang on a second, you know, my great-grandparents, they had no hot and cold water, they had no toilets, no heating, no bathing. You know, they didn't have a refrigerator, they had very little electric. It was, you know, that's not that long ago, and they survived, and they learned how to survive through basic skills. Now, we have completely forgotten these basic skills. I mean, let's be honest, most young people nowadays think that the way, you know, the way food is, the way they get food is they simply press a button on their smartphone, call an app up, order it, and it turns up on their door.
Right.
And they're charged from their bank account, all via technology. You know, I mean, if the technology side of life was to break down, which could be an internet break, you know, the internet could go down, power, whatever. How are these people going to eat? You know, they think they just press a button.
As you hear about everything that's in the news today, you know, hearing about websites being hacked and that sort of thing, do you feel like it gives you credibility that people now are turning to you saying, hey, maybe you have something here?
Well, I have seen a substantial increase in the number of people that are looking for information. And that can only tell you that there is a concern. I mean, people, when you read about possibly things happening and people see that things are happening, like you say, websites being hacked and not just run-of-the-mill websites, but government websites.
Absolutely.
Exactly, and very, very high-profile websites where your details, my details, everybody's details are being just taken by these hackers to be used how they want. You're in quite a vulnerable position, and if your bank account is suddenly wiped out, you've got no money, then really you've got to think to yourself, well, hang on, I've got to get to work, I've got to put petrol in my car, I've got to pay for it, and I've got no money to pay for it. It's been hacked out of my account. You know, it can be a dodgy situation, but it's all about these what ifs, you know.
Right.
And you can just go on and on. I can say, well, you know, if this happens, you should do X, Y, Z. And you'll reply with, but what happens if, what do you do if this happens? And so on. It's just being generally prepared.
Yeah. So how far have you gone? You know, I've read articles that talk about people who have, you know, 50 pounds of water, not water, but 50 pounds of lotion in their basement, or people who store up lots of batteries because they can barter with it because they think we will go away from having a monetary, you know, money, that sort of thing. It would be all about bartering. Have you gone that far?
Bartering is considered. You know, if we were to have, you know, a full-on disaster situation, you know, almost to like a doomsday type of situation, then bartering would be, you know, the only way to get new goods, or, you know, if you want something and to exchange via the bartering system, that would definitely, you know, that's a gimme. That would definitely happen.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, most preppers are very reluctant to tell you what they do and don't have, and they're also very reluctant to tell you where they've got their stock. You know, this is all part of the theory that, well, not the theory, it would happen. If something were to happen and I've just told every man and his dog, oh, you know, I've got X amount of this and X amount of that,
right,
and they can't get anything, they're going to come knocking on my door.
Right.
Which is where, in this country, we have, as preppers, a little bit of concern about it. In the States, yourselves, you've got no problem because you've got, you know, you can arm yourself.
Mm-hmm.
We can't over here. You know, the police will come and shoot us if we arm ourselves. You know, that's our only downfall. So preppers, especially in the UK, is an underground movement that don't tell a lot of people. I mean, yes, most people can be tracked down. In my personal case, you'd be hard to find my food and supply stores, you know, because I don't keep them directly where I live.
Mm-hmm.
I keep an amount,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I distribute my stashes, as it were.
Are you married with children? Do you have a family?
I'm married, yeah, but my kids are all growing up now.
Uh-huh. And do they believe in what you're doing as a prepper?
To a degree. I really got heavily into it, as it were, once they were grown up and had families of their own. I mean, had they been younger children, they would be brought up with it a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
But they do understand, and they do prep to a degree. You know, maybe.
But do they
quite.
Feel like you've gone too far?
Well, how far is too far? You know, that's the thing. I mean, yeah, I might have enough supplies for, you know, let's pick a figure out there. Let's say nine months worth of food supplies. You know, without needing to go, to literally leave the house more or less. Now, some people would say that's too far. Some people would say it's not far enough. But then you've got to add to that the fact that I go out of my way to learn the old skills.
Right.
You know, these old skills of, you know, how to fish, to hunt, to
track
animals.
It sure can't hurt us. It can't hurt us to learn, right?
And
that's why
right.
It's such a big movement here, that's for sure. If people want more information, because I think on your website, if I'm not mistaken, you have some clues on how to get started and things that you may want to pick up and that sort of thing. So
yeah.
If they're interested in learning more about the Preppers of UK, where do they go?
It's ukpreppersguide.co.uk. You know, I mean, it's if you just put in UK preppers in a search engine, the site will come up as the top one normally. But it's got quite a lot of information on there, from generally about prepping, hunting, basic survival, through to the some of the laws in the UK. It's predominantly a UK site. I do get a lot of interest from the States.
Yeah. You know, the electricity just went off the other day in the house, and I sat there and thought, now, if this continued for 2 weeks even, how would I get the water? How would I know how to filtrate water and that sort of thing? So those are things we all need to be looking into.
Without
that's
a
for
doubt.
Sure.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
You know, because you simply don't know. And I would say to any of the listeners now, when you get home tonight, or if you're home now, turn your electric off. And just stop and think, well, hang on, how do I cook an evening meal? How do I do the lights? Is the heating going to work? Is the aircon going to work? Is the telephones going to work? And then don't just do it for an hour. Do it all day.
And then you'll see why this is
you'll
important.
You'll really start to see it. And if you live in a cold area,
You find out quickly.
You'll find out very quickly.
Hey, Steve, I wish we had more time, but what a pleasure to have you join us all the way from the UK. We sure appreciate it.
Very nice speaking to you, Geraldine. It's appreciated.
You too. That is Steve Hart. And, of course, you can check him out on ukpreppersguide.co.uk. We'll be back in a moment. It is now 11:28 here at WCCO. Welcome back to the John Hines Show. I'm your host, Geraldine Steele. We were just talking about preppers, or survivalists, as many of us know them. There are many of them in this great country of ours, and they are really preparing. Now, a lot of us think of them as the crazies, the ones that go too far. They have bunkers, kind of like the ones in that movie called Blast from the Past with Brendan Fraser and Christopher Walken. You remember that movie when they were, you know, stuck in the underground bunker and trying to survive what they thought was a new. Think of them like that. However, there's some reality behind, you know, being so connected to technology that it can cause some major problems. Particularly, you remember the blackouts in Southern California, the rolling blackouts they used to call it when the power grids would go out. Well, there's still some concerns about that in 2014 and even this year, 2015. Absolutely. And what do you do? He's absolutely right. What do you do when there are rolling blackouts that last far longer than a few hours? Right? That's a whole nother ballgame. So we do need to know what to do. So if you think that they're crazy, yeah, maybe they are a little nuts on some level, but we can all learn from them. We know exactly what we need to do. And you can always go online and check out their checklist, like heading to the nearest discounting store and getting 20 pounds of white or brown rice and 20 pounds of pinto beans, you know, 5 pounds of mixed beans and 5 pounds of white sugar and 5 pounds of iodized salt and a gallon of olive oil. I mean, these are things that they're saying to do to survive, because we never, ever know, do we? So let's stop calling them crazy. And let's just say it, we can learn from them, right? My father used to say, you can learn from anybody, whether it's a wino or a pastor, anyone. Or you can learn how not to be, right? So there you go. All right, it's 11:30 already. I have to take a break, don't I? Oh, man. All right, we'll be back in just a moment. It is now 11:37 here at WCCO. Welcome back. You are listening to the John Hines Show, and I'm your host, Geralyn Steele. As you heard a minute ago, we really do want you to go to listen to the podcast of this show and all the shows here at WCCO. Just go to play.it. That's right, play.it, and you can get those podcasts. Well, when it comes to donating, many Americans like me and like you, it used to be pretty easy, huh, to decide who to give to. I remember, you know, putting the money into the Salvation Army bucket every Christmas, every holiday, right? Or writing out that check to the United Way or to whatever my favorite charity was. I didn't have any problems. You write it out, you send it off, and you don't think another thing about it. You believe in what they're doing. But we've been warned that when it comes to donating to charities, we have to be careful. We have to be educated, knowledgeable about the corporations, the companies, the agencies that we give money to. Now, as you've heard, the big story that came out just a couple of weeks ago with Jared Fogle, who's the big iconic Subway spokesperson, his charity never lived up to its hefty promises. The Jared Foundation, which promised to give $2 million to schools and organizations to teach healthy eating and nutrition to kids, well, it hasn't issued a single grant. And this is from the USA Today. Instead, most of the charity's expenses went to paying the salary of its executive director, who, by the way, was busted on child porn, but that's a whole nother story. Bottom line is that it's not as easy to choose who to give money to. And then you have to really go a little deeper. Well, how deep should we go? How does that process work? With the president of Charity Watch, a watchdog group, is joining us, Daniel Borachoff. Did I get that name correct, Daniel?
Yeah, Borachoff is correct. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us here at WCCO. You know, we hear these stories, and every time it happens, we close our wallets a little tighter.
Right, but you don't need to do that, because if you just make a little effort, you can accomplish a lot more with your giving. And the Jared Foundation, as an example, if you would just merely look to see if he was walking his talk and just glanced at his tax form, which are widely available on the internet, we leak to them at charitywatch.org or his audit, you would see that he's collecting and spending very little money. I mean, typically less than $100,000 a year, even though he's getting all this great publicity and credit for helping with the child obesity problem when he really isn't doing it. And people need to be particularly careful with celebrity charities, being if they're sports stars or movie stars or TV spokesmen, that they may be doing it just to enhance their image so people will like them more. And people got to get away from being so surfacey and just, you know, figuring out what's really going on. And just, and so the problem, Geralyn, is that the average person that gives actually only 30%, it's worse than that, will go any further than what the charity tells you when they ask you for money.
I'm one of them. I was the girl that did absolutely that. And by the way, I didn't see anything wrong with a charity using 60% of their money to pay the salaries of those who really know how to deal with this issue, whether it was homelessness or whatever. I want people to make a good salary so they can stay committed.
If they're doing the work. Or an educator or nurse. Or that's another myth that people don't understand, is the work of these nonprofits needs to be done through paying people to do the work. Salaries are not bad, just as they aren't in any business or organization. You got to pay people to do the work. Robots can't do it, at least not yet.
Exactly, and we should pay them well because they really are doing incredible work. These are people who work long hours and hard. I get that. At the same time, I don't go deeper. So where do we begin to go deeper to find this? What websites are you talking about?
At CharityWatch.org, we list our top-rated charities in 36 different categories: animals, environment, children, cancer. So there's also we also link to many different places like the Economic Research, the Foundation Center, National Center on Children's Charitable Statistics, ProPublica, Nonprofit Explorer, and then also you know, the states have information that's available. But it is a challenge to sift through all of this and really understand what it means, because there's a lot of variation and manipulation in the reporting. But I think people can at least get to a common sense level of does it make sense what they're saying, and can you point to accomplishments or specific things that you've done? You know, you're not giving to a nebulous cause. You're giving to an organization that's doing specific things to help and get them to quantify it as much as they can. I mean, of course, there's a lot of pitfalls, and, you know, a lot of the groups have very similar names. We have groups that, you know, one gets an A grade and one gets an F grade. They have practically the same name.
Yeah.
We think that at least it shouldn't cost more than $35 to raise $100. The better groups are able to get 70% or more of their budget to programs. It's certainly better to give directly. There's a lot of handy little mechanisms to give, but if they're taking a haircut or a piece of the contribution when you can so easily give directly, that would be something that, you know, less risky way of giving. Don't let them pressure you. If they're putting a lot of pressure on you, then that may mean that they're trying to the great cause isn't that great, because if it's a good cause, they don't need to put heavy duty pressure on you. And don't let your use your head. Don't let your emotions get to you. Beware of gifts. You know, gifts can just be a little ploy to make you feel obligated to give. You're under no obligation. If you receive like a gift in the mail, you don't have to give in response to it.
Ooh, that's so true. I remember that. You get a really shiny map or some really nice bag, you do not have to. They wanted to send it to you, it's yours.
Right, exactly.
Now, I will say this. When it comes to nonprofits raising money, you know, they don't necessarily brag about all that they've accomplished. Every now and then, you'll get some stats to say, look at all the people that we help. But they don't rest on those laurels, even within one letter. You know, they immediately turn around and go, okay, we did all of that, but guess what? We really, really need your help, because we need to continue to do this, do that. A lot of us don't continue to watch them. You know, you find out that they're really good, they're on the list, they're doing great, I'm going to give to them. And you'll keep giving to those charities because we're loyal for the next 5 years. But maybe within that time period, things have gone awry.
Oh, right. Well, typically, you know, groups will talk about their long, illustrious history of what they've done. Well, that may be true in the past, but what are you doing now? So it's a good idea to ask for your budget or plan to see what they're looking to accomplish now. And I think that's a clue. If they're not being specific in the recent year and they're just talking about a lot of stuff from the past, then that's a good clue that maybe they're not doing too much at present.
Right. Now, there are a lot of organizations that are based here in America, started here in America, but they do international work. How do we secure ourselves on the international giving, the money that goes out? And it's hard to keep up with where it's going and how it's managed.
Well, we have a lot of great international charities. You can see the top rated ones at charitywatch.org that do work around the world. And one thing that I do advise people is be really careful though with those groups, because according to our disclosure rules that the IRS has, they're allowed to hide the international grants, who they're giving it to, what they actually are. And there's been some problems with donated in kinds being of questionable value, sending all kinds of things that like food that's about to expire, fur coats to the tropics, I mean, things that don't make any sense. So what you really want to do is follow the cash, and this is something we do at Charity Watch. How are you spending the dollars that you receive? If you get a lot of donated goods that may be of questionable value flowing through your books, that may make you appear to be accomplishing a lot more than you really are. So it's important to follow those dollars and see how the group's actually spending your charitable contributions.
Should we punish some of those that have had one person internally that is, you know, giving them a bad name? The organization overall is a good organization, but, you know, like you have the Charity Watch Hall of Shame. By the way, love that. Thank you so much for doing that, right? And you mentioned one who worked for United Way of America. A lot of people believe in the United Way, and yes, he defrauded the organization, but do we punish United Way for all the great work?
Well, I think you need to for at least for a period of time, because he was the guy who created the rules under which nonprofits operate under. He was an incredibly influential, important, powerful figure. So, but I think that happened, you know, decades ago, and I think we can get over that. But I think with the United Way, you got to look at each chapter because each chapter is very separate, and see what, you know, if you want to look at, you know, your Minneapolis one or whatever town that you're in, and see how well they're doing. And they can offer a valuable service, because what they do is they look at what's needed in the community and which groups are better able to meet those needs. So they can actually offer a valuable service. So certainly you want to, if the group is really addressing the community needs, then you want to support it.
And what about new startups, those companies that are, those agencies that are starting up, they're looking for the dollars to just get going, to buy the clothes for the homeless or buy books for children that aren't in school, that sort of thing.
With that, you got to look at the track record of the people involved. Are they credible people? Somebody called me from California and was asking about a brand new startup charity. Turns out the lady that was starting it had warrants for her arrest in multiple states, and she was running this charity. So he's, you know, not a good likelihood of success with that.
And that's easy to just look their names up and figure out what they've done.
I mean that is something, but you may not have to go that far. But if they're not able to show you that they have a good background and they're competent people to be able to run and operate a charity, also the board of directors are the people that you would trust and respect, then you probably shouldn't, you know, then you ought to look elsewhere, because it really depends on the people setting it up on whether it's going to be able to, you know, be successful.
I sure appreciate that you exist, can I just say. And again,
well,
if you want more information, you can go to charitywatch.org and really peruse the website. There's a lot of information there. There are tools and tips of how, you know, you can, what agencies you could, how to research them, how to look them up, that sort of thing. You guys have a lot of information out there. And of course, there's somebody out there that's also watching you. And I can imagine you hold your head up high, knowing that somebody can look into your record, look into who you are as Charity Watch, and say, they're doing a great job.
Oh, yeah. When you're very public about criticizing
high-profile
things, can be subject to criticism yourself. And we just, you know, we want to get that information so people know what's going on, because there's a lot going on that people are not aware of, and a lot of eye-opening stuff out there that people would be really surprised to see.
And were you the founder of Charity Watch?
Yes,
I
founded it.
What made you do it?
Well, I have a background, financial background, and I just knew that there's so much the public doesn't know about, and it's so easy for these charities to manipulate their finances to appear that they're spending their money really well and accomplishing more than they are. That I just was just really driven to let people know what's going on, because this is one thing that makes America great. This is one way we can really improve the world.
Right.
And it's a shame that we waste so much so many of our charitable resources. And it's not.
And how are you funded?
We have about 9,000 members that believe in the cause of informed giving and want access to our information. And for only $50, people can people can support us and get access to great information so they can accomplish a lot more with their giving.
So you're a charity watching out for charities. There you go. CharityWatch.org is how it works. And president of that organization is joining us, Daniel Borokoff. Thank you so much for joining us, Daniel.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Right now it is 11:50. Time to search for custom replacement windows. Search Wellington Home Improvements. 11:53 here at WCCO. Good morning and welcome back to the John Hine Show. As we wrap up these last few minutes, just wanted to give you an overview of charities. You know, we are giving people in this great state of Minnesota. We really are. And I love that about us. And I don't want us to start cutting back and saying, oh, I can't trust this, or I don't know enough about this company. If you don't know enough, it's time to look. And that takes up time, doesn't it? It does. I look back at an article from the New York Times back in 2013 that says, you know, a good benchmark for a worthwhile charity is seeing that they use at least 75% of income on their programs. 75% of their income should not be on the salaries, but be on the programs. They made that very, very clear. Okay, well, if that's the case, what else do we need to know? Well, they say that you're going to have to go deeper. You're going to have to look into the fine writing, the small writing on the contracts in the websites, and looking at their how they spend their money, that sort of thing. It says, see if you how they prepare their charity form. The annual reports, the financial statements, ask the questions like, does the charity practice joint cost allocation? Oh, my goodness. A lot of us don't even know what that is. We don't even think about that sort of thing. But if you do, go for it. How about, does the charity evaluate its effectiveness? Does it evaluate its effectiveness? That's pretty important. Is the mission supported by academic research? That is quite critical. Now, those in the academia, you know to do that. But a lot of us may sit back and go, really? Do I need to look at that? Yeah. And then watch out for the red flags. We know that there are some flags out there. Sometimes we see them and we ignore them. We think to ourselves, it's not that bad. It's not that big of a deal. But sometimes it really is. Do you need comprehensive advice? You know, these are questions you can ask the charities themselves, or you can ask yourself about, do they need it? Is the charity sitting on too much cash? I don't even know how that's possible. I guess you're supposed to get to that zero nonprofit point. But if they're sitting on too much cash, that's a flag. And, of course, be vigilant. Stay on it. Keep looking after it. And I know I'm one of those. I love to give of my time more than money. I try to give of my time and my gifts. But those of us that do either, the bottom line is that we are giving. We are choosing to support whatever that charity is. And if it's a brand new charity, really look into it. Do the background on those who founded it, who started it. And that's something we have to do in the media. That's something I have to do, even with the guests that come on my show when I am promoting their nonprofits. Not something I've done easily, that's for sure. Not something I've done often is to go deeper. But now it's time. We keep hearing these stories. We are troubled by them. Well, let's figure out why and do something about it. Well, my goodness, it sure has been a pleasure being on with you today. I thank you for giving me the opportunity to sit in for the great John Hines, who has an amazing resume and coming to radio. There's so much more I wanted to talk about, like before a robot takes your job, you'll be working side by side with it. There are plenty of Americans in the automobile industry that know all about that. But we're going to save these sort of articles that the producer of this show, Kyle Sheely, has pulled, and I'm going to pass them along so that you can listen to them. Some of the responses we have and some of the guests will feature on Sunday night. Again, the show is called Steel Talking. I'm your host, Geraldine Steele, on Sunday nights from 7 to 11 p.m. It is what I love to do, is sit here and gab with you. So hopefully you will stick and stay with WCCO. See you next time.